Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Hi, I'm Jen White, and this is The Morning Shift.
I think performance helped me understand the musicality and the sounds that come with poems.
That's Kara Jackson, the newly minted National Youth Poet Laureate. We'll hear from the Oak Park native in just a bit, but first...
Well, it's a done deal. Congestion pricing will be driving into New York City.
The very first city in the nation to levy a congestion tax on drivers.
To unclog the streets and raise money for mass transit, the panel wants drivers to pay a fee to enter Manhattan south of 60th Street.
That's right. Congestion pricing is coming to New York City. So as Chicago's new mayor and new aldermen look for ways to raise money, lower pollution, and clear traffic, could the same thing happen with the Loop? How would it work? Who would be charged? Michael Peddle is an associate professor of public administration at Northern Illinois University. He says we're already seeing a form of congestion pricing on the state's toll roads.
Illinois, actually, as I understand it, does have a version of congestion pricing on the toll roads for trucks. There are differential tolls depending upon when the trucks go through the toll gate. So it's my understanding, I think, that in the middle of the night, the prices are lower for the trucks.
Well, let's walk through some of the details of the New York plan. A lot of people are probably familiar with Manhattan. It's an island. And anyone who drives onto that island below 60th Street will have to pay $10, which is not insignificant. How did New York come to that decision?
Well, they really have put the cart before the horse in some respects, in the sense that the governor has gotten behind this plan, Mayor de Blasio has gotten behind it a little bit later, but they haven't worked out all the details. And so I'm not even convinced that they're actually going to be able to implement it. They want to have a system whereby there's electronic verification, either through something like the iPass that we use in Illinois, or via a camera where they will then bill a license plate that is not in the system as having one of the electronic recorders. Now, the issue with that, as it would be in Chicago, is the fact that the commuters and those who use the streets in New York are going to come from multiple states. And so in order for the system to work for those that don't have an electronic means of collection, you're going to need access and cooperation from other states in terms of their vehicle registration records. Now, unlike something that we ran into with red light cameras in Illinois, it really doesn't matter who's driving. It's really on the vehicle owner. So you aren't going to run into the problem that you have to prove who's driving. So that makes it a little bit easier.
Well, how would we even begin to approach a similar model, say, in the Loop area or a larger downtown business district?
I think it's extremely difficult. And you have to decide whether this is about reducing congestion, whether it's about environmental kinds of things, or whether you're using this as a revenue generation. And depending on what you're prioritizing, that's going to make a difference, if you will, with respect to how you implement it. I think there's a lot of kinds of issues that you have to consider. And one of the things that I think is very challenging is whether congestion pricing is the best way of addressing the issue that you want to address. For example, if it was revenue generation, one of the things that you could do is a very high proportion of the automobiles that are going to come in to the city would be having to park. And so you could increase the parking tax, and that could generate revenue without having to worry so much about the electronic kind of toll, if you will. In addition to that, it probably would be easier if you confined it to the loop because there's still limited types of entry and exits. Whether you want to exempt people that live in the loop or people that live in the city of Chicago, that's another issue. Do you want to tax or put a congestion fee on delivery trucks? What do you want to do about public transit fares?
It gets complicated really quickly.
It does. It does.
So when we talk about some of the benefits of congestion pricing, you mentioned potential environmental benefits. So just explain how that works. Is it just about having fewer cars entering the city?
One of the things that you have to consider is the bigger picture. First of all, do you need less maintenance and repair of the streets once you get them up to standard? Because there is a certain environmental impact of having to tear up a street, you know, asphalt, all of those types of things. Second of all, depending upon your public transit system, switching people over to buses may or may not be as environmentally friendly as you would like. Now, Chicago has used some clean fuels in their buses, and so, you know, that might be reasonable. If you're talking about garbage trucks, for example, you're probably not going to be charging them the congestion fee, especially city trucks. Yet they're typically one of the types of transportation vehicle that's hardest on your streets and roads. So the main thing is going to be that you have less cars and trucks driving, so you have less emissions. But also, you're going to make it so that people can enjoy the environment and it'll be healthier because people are going to be more willing to walk.
But could this be seen as a regressive tax in some ways? I mean, someone who's making six figures may not mind if they have to pay a congestion pricing fee every once in a while. But depending on the price, it could hit lower income families really hard.
Yes, it could. And there's a number of ways that you could address that. First of all, I think that's a very serious concern. But one of the things that I haven't heard other places talking about with respect to both cost and with respect to the environment is it would seem that it would be logical to at least consider lower fares for public transportation. So if we find that lower income people are more likely to use public transportation and people in general are going to be more willing to use any product that you have a lower price for, you may be able to put some things back into the puzzle by lowering the fares for public transportation. But at the same time, this may be a business-oriented type of thing as to the places where these individuals would work, they may have to consider the implications. Now, some things like hotels are going to be pretty place bound, but it's possible that one of the responses to a congestion fee or a congestion price would be that some of the businesses choose to locate outside the congestion zone, and therefore you lose some economic activity within the congestion zone.
If this bubbles up as a viable possibility for Chicago, what advice would you give incoming Mayor Lori Lightfoot about congestion pricing and what should be top of mind around this question?
I think that's a difficult question to answer, but I do have a couple of thoughts. Number one, I think if you try to base this on revenue generation, I think that would be a mistake. Revenue generation can be an added thing, a external consequence, if you will. But Chicago has a reputation for preserving its lakefront and preserving open space and people being outside, even in a Midwest winter like we had revisit us yesterday. And I think my advice would be, first of all, plod carefully. Second of all, make sure that your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed, and that there's a way to do this with integrity and honesty. And third, put the issue of lower pollution up front, because if you get that as your number one issue, then the businesses can get on board with finding ways to increase or maintain street traffic at retail and the like.
That's Michael Peddle. He's Associate Professor of Public Administration at Northern Illinois University. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Kara Jackson has been named National Youth Poet Laureate. She's the second person from Chicagoland to win that title in a row. Jackson grew up in Oak Park and graduated from Oak Park River Forest High School. She's a poet, a singer, and a musician. Jackson's work focuses on racism and sexism, blackness and queerness, and the physicality of bodies, both hers and other people's. Here she is reading from her poem, On Beating Your Ass.
If you wear pants that make a man want to wear you, if you drink soda in the dark, if you grab in the refrigerator without permission, if you wear eyeshadow you can see through, if you bring a boy in here who we can't see, if you wear your hair long enough for him to get lost in, if you drink without looking first to see the colors mix, if your keys aren't out and sharp, if you wear too much oil, men can't resist slick, if you scratch what itches, if he hits and you don't leave him.
Kara Jackson joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about the poem we just heard.
That was a really old poem, so it was interesting to hear my 17-year-old self. But I really wrote that poem to speak to the kind of cultural trope and almost the tradition of whooping and beating, and how some it's rooted in protection, and how oftentimes I think in the Black community we are thought of as inherently violent and thinking about that violence as just kind of a barbarism, and like thinking about how we aren't really given those tender moments, and we're not really, we don't have access to these kind of tender intentions also, and why sometimes whooping can be an act of tenderness also, even though I wouldn't whoop my kids. But just thinking about how, like, when I would be disciplined and thinking about what my mom was wanting in disciplining me.
I want to just learn a little bit more about how you arrived where you are right now. Tell us about your first introductions into poetry.
Well, I wrote poetry in middle school, actually. I wrote a few very bad emotional poems. And then I really got into poetry when I went to high school. I went to Oak Park River Forest, and we have the largest spoken word club probably. And I joined my freshman year. I joined the winter showcase, and then I just kept doing showcases until I graduated.
What was it about poetry that hooked you?
I think the idea that I could use language to reframe myself and to build a new self using language. Mm-hmm. I think about kind of how language allows us to access a kind of autonomy also that I really didn't have when I was 14, and I didn't really understand how I could use words to present myself and to demonstrate the many parts of myself. So then once I had that, I was like, I'm going to use this.
So you said you were part of your high school's spoken word team. How did that process, spoken word performance, shape the way you approach writing?
Yeah, I think performance helped me understand the musicality and the sounds that come with poems. I think reading poems out loud can help you understand a poem more. And even when I'm writing my chapbook and thinking about the page poems, because I don't really perform poems anymore, I don't do slam, but I still will read my poems out loud to see where words fall and how punctuation can create a kind of music. And I think that was really helpful in informing my writing because I did start poems based in performance.
So as I said, you were recently named National Youth Poet Laureate. What did that moment feel like for you when you found out you were the one?
I was in shock. All the regional winners were sitting on stage at the Library of Congress. And so when my name was read, Patricia Fraser, the former National Youth Poet Laureate, who is also my best friend, she was in charge of presenting it. And that moment was just surreal for me because I just was really confused. I was not sitting on the stage expecting my name to be called. I went last. Also, I was the last person to perform, and I was just like, I don't really know why I'm performing. There were four other poets who just completely mesmerized me. But I was really just honored to be a part of that and to be in a room and in a collective of poets who are that incredible. I think all the regional winners are equally deserving of the title. So I just also want to shout them out.
One of the things that's interesting about your writing is that you write very honestly about your body, your physicality. When I was younger, I don't think I would have had the courage to do that. So how did you connect to that ability to write so intimately about yourself?
I think you put it really well. It's uncomfortable to think about bodies and to think about your own body specifically. I think maybe it would be easier if I were writing about Beyonce's body or somebody else's body. And I think that kind of uncomfortable aspect of it is what motivates me to write about my body so much. It's because I'm still grappling with the fact that I'm not completely in love with it and that I am not unique in that at all. And I think that's kind of the beauty of all of it, is that a lot of people think that poems are supposed to be very pretty and flowery, and sometimes poems are greasy and gross, and they are cheeseburgers and things that we don't really like to give flowery language.
Oh, wow. I'd really love to hear you read. You brought a piece for us today. Can we hear it?
Yeah. This is a very cute poem. It's called "The World is About to End and My Grandparents Are Still in Love." Still living like they orbit one another. My grandfather, the planet, and grandma, his moon, assigned by some gravitational pull. They have loved long enough for a working man to retire. Grandma says she's not tired. She wears her husband like a coat that survives every season. Talks about him the way my parents talk about vinyl. Returns to her love like a hymn. Marks it with a color. When the world ends, will it suck the earth of all of its love? Will I go taking somebody's hand, my skin becoming their skin? I hope when the world ends, it leaves them be, spares grandpa and his game, grandma spinning corn into weight. The digital age is taking away our winters, but there is no sun fire enough to break the solid my grandparents make.
That's Kara Jackson. She's been recently named National Youth Poet Laureate. And Kara, you just made me cry. No, because what I'm hearing there, and it's something that I was very fortunate to grow up with too, is watching a working marriage, a beautiful marriage. My parents were married for over 55 years before my dad passed. And I hear that echo of what I grew up watching too. What does it mean for you to be able to capture that in a poem and know that it's going to resonate with people who have either had a similar experience or who are seeking that experience?
I wrote the poem because I was also seeking that experience. And I think love is such an interesting thing to write about right now, thinking about how there are so many other things to think about other than love in a time right now. I think it's snowing in April and the world is doing really scary things. And so thinking about love and romance with a backdrop of kind of impending doom is very interesting also, because even though I'm very scared about the climate we're living in, quite literally and then also politically and just financially and everything, I'm still trying to figure out how do we love with that backdrop and how do we love knowing that it's very temporary. But then thinking about how love can be temporary, my grandparents have been together for like 60 years or something, and I'm not the same woman as my grandma, but how do I still access that tenderness and the love that my grandma has for my grandpa, knowing that I'm not the same exact woman, knowing that I'm not going to wake up very early and cook breakfast for my family every day, knowing that I'm not going to assume that role. I think that I'm still navigating through that, but I think that also by writing about love in our past and how in my own family history, but also navigating it through new languages and how do we speak about love with new terms and with new imagery and new metaphors, we're doing the work of still loving and continuing to access that tenderness in spite of this doom and in spite of the future that may be very bleak.
That's it for today's Morning Shift. Later this week, we're going to break out our segment See, Hear, Eat, where we talk about some of the best things to, well, see, hear, and eat around Chicago. If you have a suggestion you'd like to add, a play, a band, a reading, a gallery opening, maybe your favorite little spot to grab a bite, give our hotline a call. The number is 888-915-9945. That's 888-915-9945. We just might use your suggestion on the show. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.